Blog Talk Radio.
Never mentions the word addiction in certain company. Yes, to tell you she's an orphan after you meet her family. A lock of hair in her pocket. She wears a cross around her neck. Yes, the hair is from a little boy, and the cross is someone she has not met.
Monday night, and that means it's time for the Constitution Hour. Again, I want to apologize for our horrible tape recorder. I think it needs some new batteries, as that blasted thing just keeps dragging. It's quite annoying. But that song was dedicated to Mikey B from the Hot Seat, and I know if Mikey B listens to that, I think that song will speak volumes to his heart. And I just wanted Mike to know that he's in our thoughts and our prayers, because I know he's going through a tough time. But not to dwell on the marital problems of other BTR hosts and good friends of the Patriot families, I want to jump right into the show tonight. And I posted earlier in the chat that tonight, one of the things I want to talk about are some very important dates. Important dates in understanding why we're at the junction we find ourselves in today. And I think we can go back to many of these dates and find the root of where we're at. But we can also find a repeating cycle. And it's kind of ironic. Of course, I think the single most important date as relates to our history in this country going to be 1775. And then we have 1781 through 89, 1791, 95, 1811, 1812, 1814, 1835, 36 through 45, 1873, and the list is growing exponentially. And of course, we can't forget the 1861 to 1865 when we fought our Civil War here in the United States. So a lot of important information out there, but I want to read you from an article, and I don't like doing this frequently, but I want to read you an excerpt from an article, and I'm going to eliminate the names and some of the titles of the individuals involved, but I just want to give you a sense of kind of the rundown of what was going on. So after defeating his opponent in an election, this gentleman, along with a senator, Richard Johnson, began investigating an institution of the United States. It was believed that both the offices in Lexington and Louisville had advocated the re-election of this individual's opponent by refusing assistance to members of the Democratic Party. Johnson asked the Postmaster General, John McLean, to approach the man in charge of this institution about the issue. McLean gave this bureau head a warning that was crystal clear. He informed him personally that, being an advocate of the institution himself, he would suggest the institution appoint directors for the Kentucky Bureau from both parties in order to avoid a political crusade, a course of action that some, he warned, were already prepared to engage. For whatever reason, the head of the institution failed to heed his warning, an action that is often credited as his first mistake. Later reports from New Hampshire dealt with the same accusations as Kentucky, yet the agency head still responded to the charges in a negative fashion. He firmly denied all allegations to the effect, and in a letter dated January 9th, he told McLean that he agreed with the fact that the institution should remain free of any involvement, but he proceeded to deny that the institution or any of its members had done so. To his opponent, the issue of whether or not the institution held or intended to hold political influence was secondary. The fact remained that the institution held too much power, and not even its advocates were able to deny this. I don't know if you've guessed yet who I'm talking about. Probably not. It was President Andrew Jackson, and he was addressing Nathan Biddle. Mr. Biddle was the head of the Second Bank of the United States, whom we know from history Jackson killed the bank. And isn't it interesting that Jackson was alleging that Mr. Biddle was using public money to fund the campaign of Jackson's opponent? Sounds just like today, doesn't it, boys and girls? Some things never change. You know, on Mike's show Saturday, I got pretty heated because of the damn banking system. And it's not just central banks, but banks in general. If we go back to 1775 and our Declaration of Independence, we need to look at the reasons that we had a revolution in the first place. And the need for a revolution was brought about by government, specifically the crown. And the reason that the crown was being so obstinate is because they needed money. They needed money to finance a war. Well, multiple wars, actually. They had wars going on with France, Spain, several other small skirmishes here and there. Also, at the same time, you had conflicts going on down in the Caribbean islands. So there was a lot of vying for power. And if we look at the reasons that we institute governments to begin with, right? I mean, we've had this conversation previously. We institute governments to do a lot of things. One is protect us from other countries, other governments. And the way that our government protects us from the government next door is by waging war. And of course, wars are expensive. And what never or seldom gets asked in many of these, who is financing these wars? Where does all this money come from to wage all this war? Clearly, even back in the 1700s and even earlier than that, countries did not have enough money in their treasury to wage an all-out war. We saw this same prospect with the Romans and the Roman Empire. They rose and fell a couple of times and finally succumbed. And every time it's been due to monetary issues. And we can look at all of the other underlying factors, but the main key ingredient to every civilization's rise and fall in the modern era has been monetary. Even going back to the Mayans and the Aztecs, the Egyptians, it was always about how much gold the kingdom had in its storehouses. In fact, it was the scarcity of money, the fact that they couldn't just manufacture their own gold and silver, that gave rise to the idea of banking in the first place and hypothecating funds, what we know today as, you know, reserve banking and reserve banking requirements. So governments have always looked for a way to create money or the appearance of money beyond that which they actually have in their control. And of course, when they do that, when we undertake the venture of creating money, hypothecating it or fractionalizing it, if you will, it creates debts. And the government necessarily has to have something to secure those debts. And that something is the people and the labor of the people and the government's authority to force those people to cough up whatever amount the government decides to exact as a tax. Our founders were not stupid. They knew the game. They'd seen it played out many times. And I think if we look at the history of some of these people, we can begin to understand and see the development of the thought process, the conventional wisdom as it's become today. And the single most influential person in our early government in regards to banking was a guy named Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had cut his teeth in the banking industry, working at a counting house in St. Croix. So he was infinitely familiar with banking and how banking worked. If we go back to the Revolutionary War and just prior our Declaration of Independence, and we look, we read the documents, we get an understanding of why the founders felt that they were forced into a revolt, a revolution, and forced to declare their independence from their government. We recall, I'm sure all of us, the phrase, no taxation without representation. You see, the colonies were being taxed to fund the wars of the crown that the colonists could see no clear benefit. In fact, some of the people or governments that the government was at war with, the colonists relied on for trade. So it was really cutting off your nose to spite your face to continue paying for the demise of your partners in commerce. And so the taxation, no taxation without representation. We enjoyed no representatives in the government over in England. We looked to the Articles of Confederation and even our own Constitutional Convention. I think we can begin to get an understanding of why Jefferson and Madison both argued, as well as Mason, that the idea of a central bank or a national bank was unconstitutional. The need for the Constitution or the Constitutional Convention, we've always been told, arose out of the government or the Union's ability to pay its debts and finance the war. Now, mind you, they didn't start the first bank, and I'm not talking about the first Bank of the United States. There was a bank prior to that in Philadelphia that started in 1780 with the express purpose of funding the war. But we were well into it by then, and as we know, the end of the war or hostilities ended largely by 1782. By 1783, we were in the treaty process over in France. So when we look at the stated reasoning for the bank, it seems a little counterintuitive, because to this point, the states had all ponied up, you know, some amount of money, although they were still in debt to the Union, and that bears some scrutiny. As we move forward and look at the Constitution and how it was structured, and the structure of taxation, it's pretty clear that what the founders were trying to create is a method in which the new government would have the ability to compel the individual states to pay their, quote, fair share. And in this way, if we look at it pragmatically, we can see that the apportionment clause was exactly what was needed. We weren't talking about a central national government taxing every individual in the country. What we were talking about is representation in government and taxation being apportioned accordingly. That is to say that each state, based on its population, would receive a specific number of congressmen to the House of Representatives. That is the individual representation in government. And each state would get two senators. We didn't want the senators to be apportioned because they were representing the state. So everybody got two. But when it came to the individuals, we the people, it needed to be apportioned based on the number of people in the state, so that everyone's representation was requisite or equal to everyone else's. No one was being unduly represented or underrepresented. Ironically, this is exactly how the apportionment clause works for taxation. The government would determine an amount of money needed from the states, let's say, to prosecute a war. We use the Revolutionary War as an example. I said, okay, well, we need $10 million to fund our current campaign against the Crown. And under the apportionment clause that's in our Constitution, each state would undertake a census And then whatever percentage of the whole their population represented, that would be their percentage of the $10 million they owed to Congress. It's a pretty straightforward way of funding the government. Aside from that, the government would get funding through other means of taxation, excise taxes, duties and imposts, and that kind of thing. All very straightforward. You see, the founders, in particular Thomas Jefferson and a few others, they knew that, number one, if you were giving the newly formed federal government the ability to tax individuals directly, that was dangerous because you were taking the power of money away from the people and putting it into the seat of government, and that certainly was not what they wanted. It certainly was not what they intended. They gave the Congress specific authority to make commerce regular, to regulate commerce, to make it even and ensure full commerce. And I think we can certainly say at this stage of the game that we couldn't be further from that if we tried. Commerce has been made irregular in our country, and we can argue the efficacy of some of the regulations and bureaucratic garbage that has gone on, and we can point fingers at one party or the other, but the reality of it is government has made itself too big to fail, to use a recent phrase that we hear all too often. And because of that, and because of the banking structure, the monetary structure, we have banks that are too big to fail. But if you go back and read the history of banking in our country and others, you see this is a reoccurring theme. The lead up to the Federal Reserve Act, 1912-1913, from 1780 all the way up to 1912, you had all these tumultuous events that were going on in our non-existent at that time monetary system. 1873 is a very important time. Some of you might have heard of a book that came out that was called The Wizard of Oz. And what many don't understand is that The Wizard of Oz was written specifically about the free silver movement and the gold act. It was the battle for monetary policy in the United States. And quite honestly, I mean, the free silver, there's two differing arguments going on between the free silver movement and the gold movement. And everybody believes, rightly or wrongly, that the gold standard, well, that's the savior. Even today, we hear people saying we need to go back to a gold standard, but I don't think they fully understand what that means precisely. One of the reasons a gold standard was preferable is because there's less of it and therefore much easier to control. Silver was rather plentiful, and they were fighting, believe it or not, back in the 1850s, something that we've heard Ben Bernanke speak about more recently, and that is deflationary pressure. They were fighting it back in the 1850s. And then we had the crime of 73, which was the demonetization of silver and switching to a gold standard, which prompted the book The Wizard of Oz and the movie that later came. You know, in the book, Dorothy's slippers were silver. And the only reason that they were red in the movie is because I believe it was Warner Brothers, but it could have been someone else. I don't know, Universal Studios. I don't know who in the hell did it, but they had just perfected their new Technicolor, and they wanted to show it off, so they made Dorothy's slippers ruby red to show off their Technicolor technology. You have Lincoln coming into the Civil War. We were just coming out of a period of a good bit of prosperity in the United States. When when Andrew, let me back up a little bit because I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. When Jackson killed the bank, he didn't do it through legislation. He did it by removing the federal government's deposits that were with the Second Bank of the United States and putting them in state banks around the country, therefore taking away the majority of the capital that the bank was holding and eventually bankrupting them. And I think anybody that has any interest at all in our monetary system should go and read through, you know, the First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States, Andrew Jackson, and understand that there's only been one time in our short, brief history in this country where our government had no debt and there was no deficit. And it was shortly after Andrew Jackson killed the bank. See, Nathan Biddle thought he'd get the jump on old Andrew Jackson, so he applied for a reinstatement of the bank's charter a couple of years early. And Jackson vetoed it. And that sent Biddle into a tirade, and Jackson took all the money out of the bank. He ordered his treasury secretary to do it, and he refused, so he fired him. And he promoted another one, and he promptly began withdrawing the money. And what happened is pretty much history, but we had a very prosperous time. Now, the First Bank of the United States, their charter came up for renewal in 1811, and Congress voted not to renew it. And I think we all remember what happened shortly after that. We ended up back at war with Great Britain in the War of 1812. So, some pretty interesting monetary history. And I think it's important to understand that history to begin to understand why our current situation is what it is. And government inevitably incurs debt. That was Hamilton's entire argument for the bank in the first place. That we had to be able to finance our debt. And quite frankly, if you go and read Hamilton's address to the First Congress, what you're reading, ladies and gentlemen, is the first in a long line of bailouts. Because what Hamilton advocated was that by creating this bank, we were going to be bailing out the states because many of them were bankrupt. Again, we need to ask the question, where is this money coming from? Who's funding it? Who were we in debt to? Of course, we're in debt to France. France had their own problems. France was hugely and massively in debt, which leads to another question. If France is loaning us money to finance the war, and France is in debt and in danger of insolvency, where's France getting the money? Surely they can't be getting it from the Bank of England. They're at war with England. Where's all this money come from? And who is it that all these governments become indebted to? I would present to you that the governments become indebted to the very banks that they create to solve their debt problems in the first place. What it ends up creating is an air of unaccountability. The bank is simply doing what banks do. It's not the bank's fault, it's Congress. Congress says it's not our fault. The damn banks. They're the ones that jacked up interest rates. They're the ones that did this. They're the ones that did all these risky moves. Well, who created the bank? Who gave permission? and who ultimately owes the debt that these banks create, including the ones that the government creates. Well, that would be us, wouldn't it? You see, it's tantamount to standing in a bucket of water in the shallow end of the pool, trying to bail all the water out of the pool while you're standing in the bucket. It's an act of futility. And for better or worse, in large part, this is why nations fail. And of course, the whole reason to have a government in the first place is to protect us from government. Right? Because there are other governments out there that aren't as benevolent as our government. After all, we pay our government protection money. So they're going to protect us from that other government. And why would that other government want to come and disrupt our lives? Well, because they want what we have. We have land. We have resources. Human resources. Productive capabilities. And for that, we use money to trade that stuff, right? So you see, from the very beginning, man is what gives money value. It's the perceived need for a medium of exchange that will allow us to exchange with others who have something we need or want that may not necessarily want what we have. So we find something that's universally attractive to everyone, that everyone will readily accept in trade. But it ends up getting turned upside down and backwards. And it really legitimizes the scripture that says the love of money is the root of all evil. Somehow, mentally, we disconnect with money. We no longer see money in our daily lives for what it is. It's simply a slip of paper or a token that represents a specific amount of time. My time, your time, someone else's time. Their productive efforts, their labors. Whether it's a business owner, a politician, a lawyer, a doctor, or a blacksmith. And somehow we elevate money, and we believe that money makes the man. And I'm here to tell you that money doesn't make the man makes the money. And when you control the manufacture and flow of that money, you control everyone who utilizes that money. You control their time. As we currently see, that we're embroiled in our political arena with one of the latest scandals through the Internal Revenue Service. And they were targeting specific groups. But I'm here to tell you, the Internal Revenue Service has been targeting a specific group since its inception. And the specific group that they've been targeting is that group that makes everything else in this country possible. Every road, every bridge, every car, every bank, every post office, every restaurant, every bar, everything. And that specific group they're targeting is you and I, the productive members of society that work for a living. Don't think for a moment that a business owner doesn't work for a living, or that a doctor doesn't work for a living, or that an auto mechanic doesn't work for a living. We all work one way or another. We're all working. And for that, we're being punished. Punished by our government. It's not enough, ladies and gentlemen, that those that don't work or won't work benefit from all of our productive labors by osmosis. No, that's not enough. The government wants us to do more for those that don't or won't work. They should get their fair share. And that's what taxation has become all about. It's certainly not about funding the government. Because were that the case, we wouldn't be $17 trillion in debt. And who are we in debt to? Let's be honest. You know, I hear this all the time, that the Chinese are buying our government. Well, how is that possible? Do the Chinese have hordes of dollars they're using to buy our debt? And what is our debt exactly? What is it? We keep talking about this debt that the Chinese are buying. What are they buying? What is it the Chinese are buying? They're buying treasury bills. The best question is, what are they using to buy them? Because if they're buying them, wouldn't that mean that that money's moving into the economy? What's China use to buy our debt? Well, I'm going to present to you that what China uses to buy our debt is China's debt, or debts of other countries. France, Germany, Spain, England. How do you buy a debt with a debt? How is that even possible? Only in our modern banking system is a debt money. Of course, it does have value, presumably. Someone owes it to you. Well, that's what your Federal Reserve notes are. A note is a debt. So your money, what you're running around trading your labor and time for, is a debt. But it has an interesting character, this debt. It can't be paid. So you have a note in your pocket that says $1. Well, what is a dollar? We probably ought to establish what that is before we agree to work for that $1. We can go into the law under Title 31, Section 5112, and we can see that a dollar, as recently as 2004, is 1 ounce of 0.999 fine silver, or a bronze-colored copper-clad coin known as a Sacagawea dollar. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd rather have the silver coin than I would the Indian maiden coin that's clad with copper. Although copper is going up in price. The point is, the banking law says, well, you can't demand payment in specie, in lawful money. And the only obligation that debt note that you carry in your pocket that acts as money, the only obligation that the banking system has to you is to give you another note in exchange for the note that you have. So they're going to pay you a dollar bill for your dollar bill. And that's all you can do with it. Now, certainly you can go get services. You can buy a piece of bubble gum or something of that nature with it. But are you really buying anything at that point? You're actually not. You're just shifting the debt. You're discharging that debt from your books onto the books of a business owner, who then discharges that debt onto the books of his supplier. But all of the debt notes tell you who the holder of that debt note is. That's the Federal Reserve System. They hold all the debt. They hold all the cards. Excuse me. They hold them all. And if you think, well, you know, I'm going to transfer some of my debt notes into some stock certificates and I'm going to buy stock in a company. Well, then I would encourage you to do a little bit of research on Seed and Company. That's C-E-D-E and Company. Seed and Company is a subsidiary corporation of the Federal Reserve Bank. And a large majority of all the stock certificates in the United States of America are registered under the legal ownership of Seed and Company. So let's see if we get this right. The Federal Reserve Bank holds ownership to all the promissory notes that we use as money, and they hold the legal ownership of 80%+ of all the stock certificates. Ladies and gentlemen, that means, quite literally, they own those companies, at least on paper. That would lead me to believe that if one bank, if one institution holds all of the circulating money, all of the credit money, and the majority of stock certificates for all the corporations in the country, it sure sounds to me an awful lot like the whole country is operating in bankruptcy. And the bank is acting as fiduciary, allowing us to discharge our debts amongst one another and with the government by utilizing the bank's own script. And for that privilege, we're going to pay a fee. You can rest assured. That's the bank's way of discounting its script. What you end up with is a pyramid scheme, whereby the bank creates loans and debts, indebtedness, far exceeding the capital that the bank has at its disposal. In other words, let's just say they're lending out 100 times what they actually have. So again, I would encourage you to go back and read about banking in the early years in our country. Go read the justifications for why we did one thing or another. You know, it's interesting to note that prior to the Revolutionary War, when Benjamin Franklin was over in England, they were inquiring about our poor, the unemployed, the destitute, and how much money we were spending on, you know, taking care of all of our destitute, despotic, poor, underprivileged people. Franklin told them, we didn't have any such thing. We didn't have poor, as that term was known. We didn't have anyone that was destitute. We had no institutions for taking care of the destitute because we didn't have any. England certainly sought to change that. One of the reasons why they stepped up the taxation and they changed the rules. You'd have to pay your taxes in the coin of the realm, which by some strange chance, very few people in the colonies were using the coin of the realm. They had no use for it. They had their own money. And they weren't dependent on the crown for their money. That is what started your Revolutionary War. Britain didn't like the fact that we were independent, and the independency was because we were independent of the British monetary system and the Bank of England. And it was that independence that caused our colonies to prosper. And the method by which the crown, the government, decided to bring us to heel was taxation. Which is precisely why the founders knew that they could not create a central government that had the authority to tax people directly as individuals unless it was in extreme circumstance. And even then, I would argue that is not what they had envisioned when they spoke about direct taxation and apportionment. I don't believe for a moment that the thought ever popped into their minds that the federal government somehow had the authority to directly tax an individual. It was all about the states and creating a union and about equal representation, representation equal to taxation. And the states were the ones that were to be taxed. Now, granted, the state wasn't just going to conjure up the money. They would need to collect it from the inhabitants of the state. But again, best left at the local level, or the state level, than it was to run all the way up to Washington, D.C. and create some huge bureaucracy, which is exactly what the central bank was. And that's why Jefferson, Mason, and others were adamantly opposed to it. But not to worry, because members of Congress realized quite readily the power that was inherent in such an undertaking. You know, we talk about politics, we talk about all the corruption, the bureaucracy that goes with it. And I don't hear anyone talking about the 800-pound gorilla in the room. That is our monetary policy. Jefferson knew the moment that you took the power of the purse away from the people and gave it to a central government or a central bank, they're one and the same, that it was only a matter of time. He also knew that we were, more than likely, we were apt to acquiesce, to go along with it, than we were to stand up and fight it at the outset. Because it's incremental. It's like the old saying, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. How do you destroy a nation? One citizen at a time. And here we are. 50%+ of our population all in favor of an even more powerful central government than what we currently have. All of these scandals only serve to prove the point that the Hydra, the multi-headed beast that is government, is unmanageable. It's absolutely unmanageable. Ronald Reagan couldn't manage it. Kennedy couldn't manage it. Bill Clinton couldn't manage it. And Barack Hussein Obama damn sure can't manage it. And neither can Congress with all its 535 members and all the various bureaucracies and all the unionizing
and all the other things that go along with it. It is untenable. It's not sustainable. And I've told anyone and everyone that would listen to me that regardless of what you do at the ballot box, regardless of what you do in your local elections, this train is going to hit a wall. And when it does, it is going to be ugly. I know there's people out there that think that they're going to be stockpiling guns and ammo and all kinds of stuff to fight their government. And I'm here to tell you, I don't believe that's true. I think the folks you're going to have to be fighting off are the folks that want to take what you have because they have nothing and they're starving and they're dying. And I believe we've got Miss Linda on the line. Miss Linda, how are you?
Fine. How are you doing? Thanks for taking the call.
I'm doing good.
You're doing
of course.
A fabulous job. I just, you know, because the history, and I did delve into it a little bit from the stuff that you had sent and from the books that I have, although they don't go into the, you know, the depth and details. One has to, you know, search those out, like the War of 1812 and, you know, with the monetary system. And why the founders, you know, did what they did, and then you talked about England saying, well, they'll put the kibosh on that, and they will tax the hell out of us and create a whole
bunch
of
people. That's exactly what they did.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't take a genius. I'm no genius
yeah.
by any means. It just takes a little bit of reading comprehension and the ability
right.
to connect the dots. You know, problem, reaction, solution. Look for that in everything. Go back to Jackson. The article on Jackson and read what they
okay.
were talking about at the beginning. What was the problem? Okay, here's the problem. You know, after the Revolutionary War, or actually in the midst of the Revolutionary War, the problem was we were in debt. Oh, God, that's terrible. What are we going to do? We need to open a bank so we can finance that debt. Well, opening a bank doesn't get rid of the debt. It
no.
simply increases it because you're going to add interest on top of it.
The whole thing is just so convoluted, you know. It drives, and when you're talking about the stockpiling and the, you know, I mean, look, they've got everything they need. They've got drones and all kinds of stuff and, you know, UN troops they want to bring out against people. You know, and you're right about the 52% or whatever who are on the dole, literally, because that's all they know how to do for how many, 80, 90 years now,
especially with the
New Deal and the Raw Deal, you know.
And
I don't
blame those people. You know what? I don't blame them for taking advantage of systems that have been put in place for them to take advantage of. That's why government created these systems. And they're utilizing them exactly the way government intended for them to be utilized. I blame us for allowing government to start them to begin with, and I blame
right.
us for being such dingbats. And it's always done out of a sense of, you know, geez, a sense of caring, you know. And I'm sick and tired of being portrayed as
mm-hmm.
a Republican, conservative. I don't
yeah.
care about anybody. Nothing could be further from the truth. On all of those counts. I'm not a conservative. I'm not a Republican. and I do care about my neighbor.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that government gets permission to steal from me to give to my neighbor.
Yeah, because you know where that comes from. That is an old, probably before Karl Marx was even thought of, you know, concept.
It's the same thing with the race card. We see it all the time. It's
yeah.
that same guilt trip.
Oh, yeah. So here's the thing. Now that we know how corrupt and how, you know, shredded our Constitution is, and we know that the ballot box isn't going to fix this, and we can't foment a true revolution,
well,
I know it's going to hit
we
a wall.
We're going to be forced into it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I know.
It's going to fail. It is absolutely going to
yes.
fail. And when it does,
right.
then you won't have a choice. You'll be forced into it.
Exactly. Yeah, because it's called self-defense at that point. It really is. I mean, I don't know how else to look at. Well, exactly. Yeah, and I get that. I mean, I'm kind of, again, I haven't studied the monetary system. I'm trying to understand it. You know, I'm trying to get more knowledge, but the way you broke it down today makes a lot of sense. It makes it easier to understand, you know, when you go back into history, because you have to see what led up to this mess. You know, and then you've got with the social programs and the it's funny how the cycle keeps repeating, because we fought like hell to get away from that stupid damn European idea from what time the pilgrims came over through all the revolution and the War of 1812. And then what did they do? Theodore and Roosevelt, Theodore and Wilson, they take this garbage, this Fabian socialist nonsense, and bring it back here. Oh, God. That's exactly what they did, and they have infiltrated us, and we allowed it to happen. You know, nobody stood up against any of them. FDR, well, any of them. Johnson,
I mean,
any of them.
You know, you look back at the founders, and they, you know, Jefferson said that government was a necessary evil. Why would he call government evil? Well, how about because every war that's ever been fought in the history of man has been fought by a government.
Yep. That's true.
With the aim of destroying, defeating another government.
Right. It's such a mess. I don't know. Yeah, I see where we're going with this, because I had a conversation at the meeting I went to yesterday with one person about, you know, elections and all this stuff, and I said, you know, talked about the right-left paradigm. I said, this is a mess. We're not going to get out of this by voting. You know, it's pretty much. But this person agreed with me because he kind of sees the handwriting on the wall and that sort of thing. But, yeah, I think people are waking up. A lot of people are. What they're going to do about it's another story. I go to the meetings. I try to educate folks. And I'm seeing more come over. You know, there's a few that you'll never reach, but are coming over to my side of understanding, at least being open to hearing about it, because what's happening is all of these things like the Agenda 21, and they're trying to take away people's farms and property rights, et cetera, it's affecting them now personally. So what I'm going to do with the next one is ask Dana if I can give us a short speech on, you know, okay, here's the puzzle, here's the little pieces, now let me kind of put this puzzle together for you, because you've got to see how this connects. You know what I mean? They've got to understand it.
Let me give you a little indicator of just how close we are.
Okay.
I've had an article here published today. Now, even John McCain is scared of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Oh, jeez. What a schmuck.
And he is. He's afraid because they left some things undefined. And McCain's looking at it and he's saying, hold on a minute. And I'll give a quote. McCain argued, this authorization was about those who planned and orchestrated the attacks of 2011. He misspoke. He meant 9/11.
Yeah.
Here we are 12 years later, and you and the secretary come before us and tell us you don't think it needs to be updated. Well, clearly it does, because it's been so long and because of the changing nature, and I think General Nagati would agree the nature of this conflict has changed dramatically, spread throughout North Africa, throughout Maghreb. It's penetrating into nations all throughout the Middle East. The situation has dramatically changed. So for you to come in here and say we don't need to change it or revise it or update it, I think is disturbing.
Wow. You know, even we've got people in our own assembly and Senate here in the state of California who just recently are trying to nullify in the state of California the NDAA, because they know how evil it is. And it's called the Donnelly Act or whatever. It's a proposed bill. And it was an interesting thing to watch on this YouTube deal, you know, up in Sacramento, because people are waking up. I mean, it's taken a heck of a long time. But, you know, thank God, even in California, man, I was, like, shocked.
Let me tell you,
they're pondering it. Go ahead.
Not to worry, but Congress is on the job. They are diligently working as we speak on wrapping up the new immigration law. And now, there it seems to be the biggest argument right now is over the fingerprinting requirement. Because what they want to do is they want to require illegal immigrants or any immigrants coming into the United States, when they leave, they have to get fingerprinted. And the argument is, well, they're only going to do it at 30 major airports because of the cost. Okay, so let me see. Every immigrant who leaves the United States has to get fingerprinted at one of these 30 airports, so don't use one of those 30 airports. That would be the first thing. And why in the hell do we want to fingerprint the ones that are leaving?
I don't know. It's crazy. It's absolutely nuts.
And once this is law, and I'm betting my bottom dollar it will become law, how long will it be before, you know, this just isn't working? What we need to do is any American, anyone, to hell with American, anyone that goes to an airport has to be fingerprinted.
Jesus. Oh, yeah. Well, what they'll argue for, of course, in the future, and I'm sure they've been arguing for it already, they'll just figure out how to try to get microchips into everybody. Well, they can run, but they can't hide.
And, you know, I was under the distinct impression that we suffer from an unemployment problem in this country.
Yeah, we do. Underemployed,
well,
whatever.
If there's an unemployment problem in this country, then the way to cure it, according to this bill, is to allow 110 million visas, work visas, or maybe it's 110,000, but it looks to me like it says 65,000 annually to 110, and maybe should have been a period instead of a comma. So 110,000 with the possibility of a further rise to 180,000 foreign workers to come in on an HB1 visa. H1B work visa. So, you know, we're so starved for jobs in this country that we're passing a bill to import more workers. What's
sick.
Wrong with this picture?
They're crazy. They've lost whatever marbles they've had. They're completely rails.
Let's look at it logically. Okay, so if we know that we have a segment of our society and a large portion of it that's unemployed, we can't call them unemployed now, can we? Because they're not actually looking for a job and trying to draw unemployment.
Exactly.
But nonetheless, they're not working for a living. How's that? So in order to make up the shortfall, we've got to import workers. Are you flipping kidding me?
Oh, they're nuts. These people, they don't have, I swear they have no common sense at all. Zero. Oh, man.
I mean, we have all but annihilated any reasonable semblance of the United States of America or what this country ever stood for. Or ever aspired to stand for.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's pretty much, and so does anybody have the timeline as to when this train's going to hit the wall?
I don't know. I haven't listened to the whole thing. I got an email from, of course, Porter Stansberry. I put the link in the chat room there. He's got a video. You know, I'm listening to what he's got to say. He's saying it's coming in the next, 12 months, which, to anybody that's been listening to the show for any length of time, I gave you a timeline from 2013 to 2015, somewhere in that stretch.
Right.
We're in the midst of it.
Yeah,
and,
I know.
You know, these imported workers, I hope none of them think they're going to come over here and get a full-time job. It's all going to be part-time now, because otherwise they're going to have to have insurance, right? No, they're going to make them part-time. That's why you're Obama and his administration have stealthily tried to change the definition of full-time to 30 hours a week.
Right. Yeah, and
we're,
I know that...
We're just in big trouble. There's no two ways about it.
It's really... You know, everybody's in huge trouble because the idiots in Sacramento, believe me, and there are many, starting with good old Jerry Brown, he's ticked off because, you know, everybody knows about the 2014 Obamacare, and all the people are already scrambling, the businesses, from large, middle to small-sized businesses, and they're going to be cutting their workers' hours because of this. They're going to be laying people off because of this, you know, to get under the radar of how many employees you have, yada, yada. So now the idiots in Sacramento, do you know what they want to do? They want to tax, fine, and punish any business who tries to do that. I mean,
you know
what they're going to do? California's going to be a ghost state, I'm telling you. They're nuts.
Dear, you're just going to have another bailout.
Oh, crap. I hope everybody refuses to bail out California. I hope they all stand. I hope every red state says watch.
This is the thing that nobody ever bothers to ask. Where do we get the money from to bail all this crap out? Where do we get the money from to run all this incrementalism? Where do we get the money from to run all this intrusive government? And the fact remains that if tomorrow morning we woke up and the federal government announced that it's nationalizing everything.
Oh, God.
There will be, all bank accounts are sealed. All wealth is confiscated. They don't have enough to pay the debt. And the interesting question that nobody else asks is, let's suppose for a moment, just in fantasy, that the government could do what Roosevelt did in 1933 and confiscate all the wealth and pay it over to whom? Who do we owe all this debt to? Oh, that's right, the bank that's going to be our savior and bail us out of our debt. Hey, wait a minute. You mean to tell me that because we're in debt, we need to create a bank so that we can finance that debt, otherwise we're in deep trouble? And when we create that bank, the debt expands exponentially, and now we're worried the bank is going to fail, and the only way we can save the bank is to create more debt so we can give it to the bank and they can continue to operate, and eventually all that debt is ours anyway, right? We owe it to whom? The bank. Because that's what you're going to find if you go and dig through all of your monetary history, not just in this country, but all the way back to the beginning of fractionalized lending, that's what you'll see. You know, it would be akin to sitting down and playing a game of poker with five friends. One of the friends is the banker, and every hand, he takes 10% from each player. Win, lose, or draw, he takes 10%. It won't take long before nobody has any damn money except the bank.
Right, right. Exactly.
And then he'll loan you money and you can play on credit, but you won't have enough to pay. You won't have enough to pay back. Even if you win, you won't have enough to pay it all back with the interest. Because you've borrowed more money than he had to lend you to begin with. And he never created the interest. It's just such a brilliant scheme. I don't know how in the hell we keep falling for it every single time.
I know. It's crazy. Well,
but look at all the great things we have because of it.
Which would be, you mean the iron fist of control? Oh my God! Plus the draconian and everything.
When I was in the army, we used to have to go out every once in a while, and they would call it policing the area. So when you ask, like, what? When you were policing the area, the rule was if it didn't grow there or it's not a rock, pick it up. Okay, so that'll pretty well cover it. When you drive down the street and you look at all the things, roads, traffic signals, stoplights, sidewalks, fences, houses, yards, mm-hmm. gardens, cars, everything. It's all borrowed. Every bit of it represents debt.
Wow.
Think of that next time you're driving around. Because every one of these companies borrowed money to start up. I guarantee you every one of those companies is operating with debt. Now, they might have enough to, you know, pay off their debt. But it's become commonplace now. Everyone finances their payroll. It's all done on a revolving debt.
Right.
Most households have at least one credit card.
I don't have any more credit cards. Yay!
That's spending beyond your means. You're your own little banker. You know, you get to create new money for a while, but you eventually have to pay it back, plus the damned interest. It's insanity. It's absolute insanity. But we rationalize it.
All those credit cards. I'm almost done paying them all off, too. Yay.
We tell ourselves that none of this would be possible without debt. Really?
It's ludicrous.
Honestly, think about it. Do you really think that it's the loan, that it's the indebtedness, the note, that's what made possible all these things? Automobiles, hospitals, airplanes, a military? They wouldn't exist if it weren't for debt, really? That's counterintuitive.
Right. It's not logical because, you know, how did all of the things get done prior to these central bank and central economic planners? You know, it's called innovation. I mean, you and you know this, probably haven't operated under true capitalism in a free market system since before my parents were born. So
Never.
We don't even know. You know what I'm saying? We don't even know what the potential could be. You know, just look what we've accomplished with this evil system. What could we have accomplished with a good one? I mean, the vision that the founders truly had.
They should have hung anybody that even aspired to be a banker.
Absolutely. Well, you know, my friend Bradley Dean, one of his websites says, you can run, but you can't hide. And he's talking about the Lord. I love him because he knows that, look, they're gonna be held accountable. It's just we have to suffer before that happens, unfortunately.
It's just upside down world.
It is.
And the thing is, it's so ingrained, it's so much a part of who we are, that we cannot fathom a world without it.
I know, and that's sad because that's the epitome of the indoctrination that has taken place for over 120 years, in my humble opinion. It's very sad. But that's where we are. Lock and load.
That's true. And, I mean, you know, we fuss and scream at, you know, one side of the political aisle or the other and the evil bastards and this and that. We've allowed this to happen. We willingly drank the Kool-Aid. I mean, we've been having a Jim Jones party for decades.
Too long. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I just pray a lot, and what I'm supposed to do, I guess, try to heed the calling. That's all I can do.
Well, you know, for me, I think it's been going through the monetary history of the country, and you look at the problems that arose,
mm-hmm.
and then look at the proposed solution.
Solutions.
And then look at the outcome.
Oh, yeah.
And it belies logic. That's why I've said repeatedly that today's problems are yesterday's solutions.
Oh,
because
yeah.
it's true. It's absolutely true.
I think the further back in history you go, the further you get away from, you know, the evils of today. I think that there may have been, now I'm just speculating, may have been unintended consequences, but for the most part, I'd say in the last 70 or 80 years, I believe they were intentional. You know what I mean? I don't trust any of these clowns.
Well, there are, look, there's certainly those people out there from all political genres that embrace the power
communism
that comes with, you know, the intent of doing something for a specific agenda. Nobody gets a pass on that. But honestly, you go all the way back to Samaria and Babylon, and these same problems existed. Now, we have at least 6,000 years of recorded history of mankind trying to solve these problems. We haven't done so yet. And we employ much the same solutions every single time. And we go back and forth from one set of solutions to another.
I know.
We roll them up and polish them up and call them something new, but it's the same old crap.
I know.
In a different package with a different name.
Well, so why can't we go with what should have been and what was really cool and actually...
Because some pitch man always comes along.
Go ahead.
Because some pitch man will always come along with a good sales pitch and never let a good crisis go to waste. And it's always during times of crisis that these new solutions pop in.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Like I said, it would be nice if we went to the actual founding and the idea that was America and why they did it and follow that. Like Ron Paul used to say, no one's following the darn Constitution for eons. And we
Linda,
should.
You're just a
damn
racist.
Let's try that.
You want to go back to slavery. You're just a racist. You just want to go back to slavery. What the hell's wrong with you? See, this is how we just deflect it and make it about race and social issues when it's truly not. What is a social issue, but it's about true freedom. It's about the liberty.
It is.
And,
right.
And taking the power of money away from government and putting it back in the hands of the person who wields it or
Amen.
Should rightfully wield that power, and that's the individual who's producing something that's beneficial to society. Whether it's beneficial to only his neighbor or an entire neighborhood or an entire county.
Yeah.
We all,
it's
you
like,
know,
who cares?
I've said it before. Regardless of what your job is, whether you're a bartender or a doctor or a dentist or even a lawyer, you're serving other people. It just works out that it's also self-serving. It's mutually beneficial. That's the whole idea of a capitalist society and a free market. It's when we try to interfere with that free market that we begin to run afoul of the term free.
Well, you know, the reason and the problem is, like you said, you kind of hit the nail on the head as far as we have fallen asleep, drinking the Kool-Aid. We allowed this to happen. And because of the nature of man, the fallen nature, of wanting to control everything and everybody, and so you get these evil ones in there, and they just, you give them one little tiny ounce of power, and they go running amok, and that's what happens. And because government, I don't care how small it is, it's got to be kept tiny because it's forceful. And that's what George Washington said, it's force, and it is also like fire. You don't contain that fire with your liberty around, you know, walking around these guys. It'll consume you. So that's what we got to keep remembering. People don't get that, Ron. They just don't. They read anything. They make me so angry.
Well, you know, it's like the song. When you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Sure.
You get a little bit of power. You get a little bit of authority. And I've seen it down at my state capitol when I was lobbying down there over some of the most ridiculous things you could ever possibly imagine. What amounts to a dispute between two neighbors ends up at the damn state capitol, and they're proposing legislation.
Wow.
Because you see there's this problem and we have to fix it. No, you don't. You don't have to fix it. You don't need to write a new law to fix it. There are laws on the books already. There is a law called trespass. It's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and So now you're advocating one position against another. There's two neighbors involved in this dispute, and you're siding with one neighbor. And you're going to apply the force of government to force the other neighbor to acquiesce.
It's pretty nuts. You know, with all these, I mean, just even the tax code, I don't know how high that, probably as tall as I am. You know, and then there's all the thousands of pages of regulations and garbage and laws. There's too many laws, number one. It's stupid regulations, fiat laws. I don't even, they're not legitimate. They're not constitutional. If we ever have, going into an ice age, I know how to warm this planet up. We can just take them and have one heck of a big bonfire because they are worthless. That's my, one of my solutions. I'm tired of it. Why do we have to have these people? Boy.
You know, because we embrace them. Because we elect them.
Yep.
We not only
unplug from that.
We not only ask them to, we pay them to.
I know, because nobody knows their rights. They don't. They have no clue how much. I don't think the people in our society today have any idea of how much power they really have. You know, how much unalienable power they really have. They just don't utilize it. You're right. We don't.
And, you know, I look around at the kids, and I hate to say this because I'm going to sound like an old fart, but I look around at the kids today, high school age and younger.
Oh.
They are so disconnected. It's frightening.
It is.
And the majority of them that I speak to or come in contact with, they all have the same blank look, that same blank, hollow,
Yeah, that's real scary. That is.
And I'm like, wow. You
boy, know, are they ripe for the pickings, huh?
We're
for
hosed
the
no matter what.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Absolutely. And I know you're running out of time, so I'm going to thank you for taking the call and say hello to everybody that's left in the chat room. And I'm going to ponder some of the stuff you gave me. Thank you so much.
I appreciate the call, as always. Always good to hear from you. I was a little concerned we haven't heard from Robert today. He's usually Johnny on the spot. So I hope everything's okay with Mr. Robert. And that was Miss Linda Sills. And Linda is one of our hosts. Linda does her show on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, called Right from the Left Coast. And, boy, if you want to know anything about Agenda 21, Linda is a lady to talk to. And she's been fighting diligently out in the land of fruits and nuts out in California. And, you know, California, Detroit, many of these other progressive strongholds are proving true the old adage, give them enough rope and they'll hang themselves. They are their own worst enemy, even though they proclaim to be doing all these things and undertaking all this bureaucracy for the benefit of their constituents. They oftentimes are blind and can't see the negative effects that these programs are having, and even when the negative effects are painfully obvious, they continue to defend them. You know, you look at Detroit, what a sad state of affairs we have going on in Detroit. Yeah, the state of Michigan has basically taken over the fiduciary control of the city of Detroit because it's defunct, it's bankrupt. It's in hock up to its ears, and there is not enough infrastructure and citizenry remaining in Detroit to pay the bills. Their tax base has evaporated, so they can no longer rely on their human resources to pay the bill. It's evaporated. All that's left are those that are a drain on the local economy and very few producers. It's just gotten very untenable. And it's really sad to see. But that is the natural consequence of the ideology, the agenda that many people promote so fervently. It's just disheartening. It's sad. And certainly, I can't imagine that anyone remaining in that area could be happy about the situation, except maybe the criminals. The criminal element has got to find it much easier to operate in Detroit now than it was even 10 years ago. I'm going to run a little promo for our shows, so give me just a few moments of your time here.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed But Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.
All right, guys, and that's our rundown of our show schedule. And I just posted in the chat that, you know, we're heading full throttle towards a collision. And we can all postulate on what that will be, what it'll look like, when it'll happen. All you've got to do is go back in history. History is full of clues and indicators of what happens when these type of events occur. Go look at the French Revolution. I'm not saying that we're going to be having guillotines in D.C. and, you know, dragging folks up and lopping their heads off, although I know there are a lot of folks out there that would love to do that. But it's going to be ugly. It's not going to be pretty. And the way that we conduct our lives today is going to be drastically changed. And a lot of people are going to get hurt. I'm afraid a lot of people are going to die. It's just not going to be a pleasant place to live. I've been wishing for years that this would have come much earlier. I would much rather have seen this collapse or collision happen back in 2007 prior to the housing debacle and all the other things. But it wasn't meant to be. Guys, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Doc, Miss Linda, Yola, Allie, Bill, and our guest. All the other listeners out there that aren't in the chat. Guys, we got to keep our heads on straight, not lose our temper, and just keep looking up. God bless everybody. We'll see you on the chat. Bye-bye.